This week's episode of Still Untitled is brought to you by Udemy, the largest marketplace for online learning. Whether you're looking to learn something new or just sharpen your skills, Udemy has over 65,000 courses starting at just $11.99. Students around the world choose Udemy to discover new passions, expand their skills, and even change careers. Visit ude.my/untitled or download the Udemy app to learn anytime, anywhere.
Welcome to Still Untitled, the Adam Savage Project. I'm Will.
I'm Adam.
And I'm Norm.
Norm, you're going to have a hard time getting that microphone up in front of your face in that high chair.
Well, I will do my best.
Okay. The people demand the microphone. The people demand it.
Yeah, I can do that.
They demand it in front of your face?
In front of Norm's face. They want that microphone.
Hey, thanks for the kind words last week. I listened to the podcast.
What, really? Nobody listens to the podcast when you're not on it.
We miss you, Norm.
Kate was great.
I'm really glad
she was able to join you guys last week.
It was good.
And she's shown us so much of the magic of the Cricut vinyl cutter.
I bought one.
Really?
Yeah. I'm going to get her to set it up for me.
It's a cool thing.
Yeah.
I've gone from, you know, we've used, I think their first exposure to a big laser cutter was the one you had in the cave here. The Trotec. Mm-hmm. Exactly. And of course, we have a relationship. We have a Universal laser cutter at the Tested office, and we have a Glowforge. And, you know, there are different classes of laser cutters, and they're very powerful. And I think, you know, you've talked about how when you were at ILM, you and Fawn Davis, once the laser cutter came into effect, it changed how you made
completely.
Things.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And I think for the current generation of makers, you could say a lot for the 3D printer, same thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and with the resources available online. But I think the vinyl cutter has been overlooked. Well, and we go to Maker Faire, and I don't even think Cricut is at Maker Faire.
They're at Maker Faire. They used to be. They're in the craft section where you didn't go.
But that's the thing. They are associated with scrapbooking and crafts.
And I'll tell you, the vinyl cutter was a machine we used at ILM heavily.
Mm.
We used it for graphics. We used it a hell of a lot for masking. So there were, in the later stages of my working there, there was some really great integration between the designs of things and the concurrent designs of their masking schemes, so that the painters would just get these sheets of masks for doing stuff. Or, and I've said this before, but like a lot of ILM ships had what's called specular highlighting panels. So it would be, the model would be fully painted and fully detailed, and then you'd go in and add clear coats of gloss and semi-gloss and matte, just squares and call-outs.
Wow, that
would,
really?
As the ship was turning the light, highlight other panel reflections. It was called specular highlighting, and it's all over the Star Trek Enterprise. It's all over the Star Wars.
We do that in games, like with software and material shaders and stuff, so that you get the same effect. But we do it on the surface. We want
added layers of detail.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
and the vinyl cutter was a key part of that.
And that's both the vinyl cutter and the laser cutter. They're so complementary in that way, but they're both just two-axis machines.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
They have a head that, you know, for these machines you can have a pen. You know, they've been plotting tools and blades that you can change out. But the vinyl cutter at, you know, $300 to $500
is a very low cost.
It's such a great entry point to thinking. I know some people have bought the Glowforge and other laser cutters, and they can do amazing things with them, but you can do a lot with so much less with a vinyl cutter.
Well, I mean, the thing the Glowforge gets you is an extra quarter of an inch, right? Like, you can do a piece of wood instead of a piece of vinyl or cloth.
I guess you can do it on the Cricut with, like, 40 layers.
Yeah, it would take you a while.
Well, yeah. And that was, like, in my head, the difference between a vinyl cutter and laser cutter is, like, okay, vinyl cutter is for soft materials, for fabric, for decals, and for things that apply on the surface, and laser cutter is for hard things. But we found with the vinyl cutter, we can do styrene. We can do, you know, 40,000 styrene.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. You can do balsa on that. So, and the skills that you learn on that device about turning 2D vectors into 3D objects, then pay forward to a laser cutter.
Absolutely.
So I highly recommend it.
When I first met Dan Shapiro years and years ago, before the Glowforge was, before they even told people what the Glowforge was.
Yeah.
He asked me a question that I'd never been asked for. He's like, you know that home CNC is a massive business already. There's hundreds of thousands of units in homes around America right now. It's like, there's not hundreds of thousands of 3D printers. What the hell are you talking about? He's like, no, man, I'm talking about vinyl cutters. Those are home CNC devices. They're in hundreds of thousands of houses right now.
Yeah.
You can buy them at every Michaels in the country, every craft store in the country.
Recently, you've been able to put your own files in them.
Well, I mean, that's probably been 6 or 7. I feel like that was an early 2010s Cory Doctorow crusade.
There was, I The Silhouette Cameo. The Silhouette was the one that was getting a lot of press about 4 or 5 years ago. And I remember heading over to Flax and taking a look at it and then doing some research and thinking, realizing that you had to basically hack it to put your own DXF files.
Yeah, you had to, if you wanted to put your own SVGs or DXFs, you had to root it and
that
do thing, all sorts
that
of stuff.
Drove me crazy. The idea that you'd make a company that made a CNC machine and then turn it into a walled. Well, what's
the razor blade model?
Why is the whole, why does everything seem to redound to AOL?
Well, so here's
AOL, like, different name.
If I can look at it from their side and say, hey, look, we want to build this machine that costs us $200 to make.
We
can only sell it for $100. How are we going to make the other $300 that we need to make margin on that product?
Yeah, no, I get that. And you open it up to all sorts of files. You open it up to other file corruptions and other difficulties. You have to support everybody else's file formats. I mean, I remember talking to someone from Apple's printer division that was like walking me through. Can you imagine what a nightmare it is to work with every other company's printer drivers and have to make these work? Some of them are brilliant and some of them are designed by people who ever use spoons. That's like just impossible.
Also the problem with the appliance model, right? Like you're buying something that's supposed to last you for 5 years, 10 years, and they can't make a business selling just one every person every 10 years. They want to sell. They need the constant revenue.
My first job out of college was maintaining an imaging lab, like where we had 18 printers and plotters and all sorts of other things.
Right.
And this was in 1998, 99. And that engendered a lifelong dislike of printers. Like that is a horrible, horrible thing to have to do to keep 20 printers running.
Oh no, I can't even.
I own
three, and keeping them running is a nightmare.
It's Sisyphean. You keep pushing that stone up the hill and getting crushed at the end of every day. Cricket's cool.
Yeah, and Bill Duran, who actually Punished Prophecy doesn't work with us, he's a contributor. He introduced me to the wonders of US Cutters, which is a website where you can buy vinyl by the rolls, and it's like,
oh,
no need to go to Michael's anymore. And if you need it, really quickly, yes, you can get vinyl there, but just like so many different types of vinyls with different finishes, carbon fiber vinyl, all sorts of masking, transfer tape, you have so much different materials to work with on that type of cutter.
The thing that blows me about the vinyl cutter is how much detail you get on the drag knife. Like you had the thing that I saw that you put the decals on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
And it's astounding how small the
quote unquote resolution.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
No, I remember when I first met the vinyl cutter at ILM, I was like, how does this work? And they're like, it's a little knife. And I'm like, no way.
Yeah, it's a CNC like, X-Acto knife, right?
Tiny. Yeah. No. Yeah. That's great.
Yeah, it's very cool.
A lot of things happening this week.
A lot of things have happened.
We should definitely talk about, let's talk about Anthony Bourdain. Anthony Bourdain, as many of you, all of you know, passed about a couple days ago, almost a
Friday.
Week ago now.
Yeah.
Yeah, by the time you're listening to this. And I know, Adam, you were colleagues with him.
I knew him. I back in the early days of Discovery, we were both part of the same family. He was on Travel Channel before it spun off.
Mm-hmm.
And so in the early days of when you're a new television show, their network often brings you to different things like TCAs, that's television critics, upfronts for advertisers in New York. And Bourdain was always back then I smoked and Tony was my smoking buddy off in the corner. Like I'd go find some dark corner to have a cigarette in and I'd always find him there. I think the first time we met was actually doing a radio show here in San Francisco, an hour long format radio show. And we had been double booked at the same exact moment.
Oh boy.
And
that's always fun.
So he and Judith, his right hand at that time, came to me and Jamie in the waiting room and they're like, hey, we're big fans. Listen, we've been double booked and Tony has this thing. Do you guys mind hanging out for an hour? And so we totally did. It was no problem.
Yeah.
But he said he was really gracious about it and really sweet about it.
So I only know him from reading Kitchen Confidential and like stories that you actually, maybe not you, but like Dave Chang tells Anthony Bourdain stories. I think he did on the Talking Room even.
Mm-hmm.
And then watching, I didn't have cable when No Reservations was on, so I never really watched that. But Parts Unknown was like appointment viewing in our house for a really long time.
It's also been our guide for traveling.
Yeah.
It's like, has he eaten there? Let's go there. That's how. I mean, that's how my wife and I have eaten at many of our favorite restaurants we've traveled to.
She once told me your restaurant finding trick for new cities, which is go look and see where Tony went on no reservations or parts unknown and just go there. And it's a spectacular trick. Don't tell anybody.
You know, and this was talked about a lot, and it's something I really appreciated for a public persona like Bourdain, was Kitchen Confidential and the article in The New Yorker that preceded it are angry books. They're brilliantly written, but there's a lot of jaded, complex feelings about the industry that he's in. And it was lovely over the course of the last 15 years watching him in his writing fall in love with food from a completely different angle and really talk about his misgivings about his form, about having been a chef and how he treated his staff and the ways and what he prioritized back then. You know, I thought it was a crime for years that he wasn't winning Emmys for writing because his writing was so good.
Definitely the best of reality TV. Well, that's the best of all TV.
That's a thing that we didn't realize that's what he was doing. He wasn't a personality and just a personality. He wasn't just a chef. He wasn't just a world traveler. His show was his writing.
No, the programs were, as far as I'm concerned, the programs were all a vehicle so that he could write.
They were essays.
That's exactly right. And so this is the last time I saw him was when he won his first Emmy. I think it was now 4 years ago. Jamie and I were actually presenting at the Emmys. And we presented the category for best writing, and he won, and hand him his Emmy. And we were both staying across the hall from each other at the Marmont, which is where he lives in L.A., lived in L.A. practically. And it was great to see him finally win for that, and I think he actually won again. I can't quite remember off the top of my head. But, I mean, look, as somebody who had a long-term show and has pitched other shows, I love the fact that every show he did was sort of a version of the same exact thing. All the refinements of them, the layover and no reservations and parts unknown, the slight refinements that made them different was awesome. But again, I just loved listening to his writing.
The reason I was there was to hear him talk about places, going places, and make me excited about going to places that I probably am never going to go. Like, I'm never going to Myanmar. Right, Myanmar, but like
one of the only other countries in which they don't use metric, like us.
Yeah, but hey, congrats, nice job, America. Yeah. But you look at that and you watch that episode and he makes you see it through the eyes of him, which is like without judgment. Like he didn't judge. He would go places. He would talk about food. He would eat things that most of the people watching would never consume,
Enjoy the community that he met while he was there.
But it wasn't like a fear factor situation where he was trying to eat something for shock value or whatever.
No.
It seemed like he wanted to appreciate what was happening there and what the community was all about and embed himself in that community for as long as he had time there.
And his medium for those shows, it was television. It's a visual medium. And the writing carried a lot of it. But also, as you know, Adam, working with your production team and how, you know, your relationship with you and your camera crew and your producers evolved over the years, he had a very tight relationship with his production crew at 0.0. And Joey would point out all the time, like, the evolution of the ways they told those stories visually was so interesting.
They
not only
much
just
more cinematic about it.
God, when Parts Unknown started and, oh.
Yeah, I thought a lot about that. Of like, he's traveling 250 days a year with the same 10 people,
right?
And really, there's a level of family about that that's hard to conceive of unless you've been inside of it.
And also to get out of the way of the naturalness of his interactions, right? Because they're not in the studio, they're not in controlled locations, they are around the world, and as much as you can produce it. You know, that's the problem. Difficulty with the reality shows on location is how do you make it feel authentic? And you always felt that with the way he interacted with people and the way those stories were told. Also, the crazy editing. There's one episode I was watching on an airplane where they edited backwards.
It was
in Korea,
really?
I believe. It was a Korea. I want to say it's Korea, but it was like a Memento style episode where, you know, it was like a night of drinking.
Nice. Did it begin with, how did we get here?
And it was cold open into like a sequence, and then they would overlap a little bit and go backward and backward, and he wrote it that way.
Wow.
And it was mind blowing. You know, it never rested on his laurels.
Mm-hmm. Well, and from watching, like, he was able to appreciate anything. Like, he appreciated everything from the lowest of low street foods, the elote, and not this is a low street food, but like, it's a piece of corn with some cheese on it, and done right, it's transcendent, and done poorly, it's mayonnaise and corn and cheese.
Still
wasn't that bad. I mean, yeah, you put it that way, it sounds okay. But yeah, the celebration of the food without artifice and without all of the bullshit around high end cuisine sometimes was always really, he was the intelligent answer to that other guy who does the other show that I'm not going to talk about right now,
but also highly influential in terms of YouTube culture and travel vloggers, mm-hmm. right? Like, yeah. And even David Chang's show on the Ugly Delicious, there's a whole genre of travel and food storytelling now that I think has its roots on what Bourdain's team did and No Reservations, and a whole culture of people who travel the world and document their journeys on YouTube and on other places that have their roots in that. And I don't think none got to that point because he had done it for so many years.
I also appreciated his how vocal he was about the Me Too movement.
Yeah.
You know, I thought he was both articulate and just as angry as as to be expected. You know, I appreciated that voice and his voice in the middle of that. Yeah. I can't stop being sad about this. It's really kicks my ass.
Usually when people who are famous pass that I don't know personally, which is most of them, it's like, oh, well, that's a loss for the arts or that's a loss for the culture. But I'm profoundly sad that I won't hear any more of his stories.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Like when David Carr passed, I felt the same way. The New York Times mm-hmm. columnist, the last good New York Times columnist, perhaps. And like, he was a force for honesty and truth and was one of the good people. Yeah. At least it seemed like and the things that came out after he died seemed to reinforce that. But mm-hmm. yeah, it's a real loss. It's a blow.
Yeah. This week's episode was also brought to you by Stitcher Premium. Stitcher Premium gets you completely ad-free episodes of hundreds of shows like Comedy Bang Bang, WTF with Marc Maron, and How Did This Get Made? You also get 21,000 hours of exclusive content, and new exclusive originals like Marvel's Wolverine and Issa Rae's Fruit are launching every week for Stitcher Premium members. If you love podcasts, you gotta check it out. When you listen to ad-free episodes in Stitcher Premium, your favorite podcasters also get paid. Help support your favorite shows and join Stitcher Premium today. For a free month of listening, go to stitcherpremium.com and use the promo code UNTITLED. Moving on, there's no way to transition.
There's no clever segue for this one.
No.
Period. Just a period.
Yes. Well, there we go. We had our moment. I do also want to talk about something that came out this past week that I think we can all get excited about. Yeah. And it's something we've known that's been in development for a long time. We first got first glimpses of First Man.
Yes.
Which is I guess it's a biopic about Neil Armstrong.
It is starring Ryan Gosling, directed by Damien Chazelle.
Well, I didn't know if it's like the right stuff about the culture of that Apollo 11, but it's more about the person.
It looks like it's about Neil Armstrong.
Yeah, it's about the person more than the mission.
And Armstrong was a remarkable human being. I mean, a lot of people described him as humble. He was very careful and very vocal. We reached out to him to participate in the Mythbusters moon landing episode. Mm-hmm. And if I remember correctly, we didn't get rejected out of hand, which was huge for reaching out to him to do television, mm-hmm. because he was really clear that he wasn't interested in celebrating himself because he felt like he was just the person strapped to the front of a rocket that a million people worked on.
Yeah.
And was really, really vocal about the machine that is NASA that engendered this exploration and that he was simply the business end. And I really, like...
That's amazing.
An impressive level of consciousness about one's place in culture and where one wants to be, where he wanted to be.
I mean, you have to imagine that being the first person to walk on the surface of another world is has the potential to turn you into a monster, right?
Well, only in the Marvel universe.
but no, I mean, like the amount of the ego boost that that gives somebody who isn't incredibly grounded is.
But it's naturally counteracted by that overview effect. And I think it's hinted at the trailer.
Yeah.
There's a line that, you know, Gosling says, and I'm not sure if it's actually attributed to Armstrong, but, you know, the perspective you have when you're up there mm-hmm. and seeing the world that small and the entire world in one field of view, that humbles you.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you can't have an ego. But the trailer looks fascinating. It's Damien Chazelle who did La La Land and the drumming movie, Whiplash. And yet this doesn't look like a musical.
It's not.
It looks straight
God,
biopic.
That would be so amazing. If it's one small step for a man, one step for a
man. My concerns about this, and we'll talk about like the technical aspects, because I want to ask you, Adam, when you watch the trailer, what you thought about it, like the costumes and the setups. But I hope to distance Ryan Gosling from Neil Armstrong.
You don't want
to
see the guy from
Drive. I don't want to see Ryan Gosling. I want to see someone else.
You know, it's hard to, like... And maybe you should post this underneath the posting on this.
Yeah.
The pictures of there's some pictures of Armstrong in the Apollo capsule and also in the Gemini during Gemini missions, and he looks like such a baby. I mean, he can't be older than I don't even know how old he was.
He was probably mid 30s, right?
Maybe
by the
but
Apollo.
In some of these pictures from Apollo days, he looks maybe like he's 25. Just so cherubic faced and. There's
a little bit of tough hair over the Snoopy suit.
The smile on the Snoopy suit is the one I think
photo.
About.
You know the one that I mean. Yeah. And like, there's a line in the trailer where Armstrong's wife says, "You are a bunch of boys. You are not in control of anything." And I'm like, yeah, no, that sounds about right. Like,
and that's what I hope. Like that photo that we all know of Armstrong in that moment of elation. Like, I want to see a lot of that, and I don't want it to be melodramatic because I know they're in the trailer. They telegraph a lot of. You know, conflict and yes, it has to be a dramatic story and his inner turmoil and fear
so
and courage.
You're worried that they'll overplay that.
Yeah. Or at least I hope that what they have not shown us is that the joy and the celebratory moments of being the first man. But to the point of the technical accuracies of the costuming and the era, what do you think, Adam?
Look, I was looking at all those costumes with a very sharp eye. I watched the trailer 3 times. I'm looking at the helmets. I'm looking at the connectors. I know, obviously, Ryan Nagata, friend of Tested, did some of the costume work for it, did some amazing pieces. Chris Gilman at Global Effects did a whole bunch of the suit stuff, and I've talked to both of them extensively about the stuff they did for the film, and like it looks like the fidelity is beautiful. I get so excited watching trailers like that from just the costuming and technical standpoint.
Well, and I got it. Like, I didn't know anything about this movie beforehand. I didn't know it was coming. I haven't paid attention to it at all. And I saw the trailer during the NBA finals, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like stopped and tried to rewind and like watch it again.
Yeah.
Because for me, this kind of space movie that's about actual, like, compared to, say, Gravity or The Martian, and The Martian is like, I was really excited about The Martian. Apollo 13 was a transformative movie for me.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it was the first time I'd heard that story outside of books and stuff like that. And it was depicted in such an, with as much accuracy as they could create.
Yeah.
And it's an incredible film. It holds up incredibly well now, even with like early CG and all the stuff that went into it. And I'm so excited to see this story because of that.
People love space, right? The space loving community, whether it's collectors or historians. They hold movies to a certain regard about space, whether it's The Right Stuff or Apollo 13 or this, because we only get these few chances. And yes, there are documentaries, plenty of documentaries about space race.
From the Earth to the Moon is incredible.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But in terms of how mainstream culture perceives the journey, and we only have these few tentpoles. And it's unfortunate because not everyone's going to watch From Earth to the Moon. But everyone knows Apollo 13, and people know The Right Stuff, and people now know Hidden Figures.
And hopefully this is part of that.
And it needs to stand in that pantheon of the pop culture representation of one of the most important moments of human history.
I'm really curious about Damien Chazelle. It's a weird choice for Chazelle. It just feels like a weird choice. I could be wrong. I haven't seen Whiplash because I didn't want to subject myself to that. It looks exhausting.
Whiplash, the one with J.K. Simmons?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. The one that's it's brutal.
Unbelievable.
It's
amazing. It's really amazing.
That's
what
I heard. But
I will never watch it again.
Yeah,
like,
so
it's right up there with Leaving Las Vegas and the other big bummers.
Darren Aronofsky's filmography. I just don't need to subject myself to that. But I loved La La Land when it came out. I have watched it since then, and it hasn't hit me as hard as it did when it came out. I haven't loved the music as much. I have some problems with it, even though I think it's a beautiful film.
So to go back to Whiplash, though, it isn't in the same category as Darren Aronofsky films. Like, the thing that's hard for me about Whiplash is that he makes both sides of that relationship very, very easy to empathize with as the audience. And that makes it difficult because J.K. Simmons is an absolute monster. And the kid is a victim of a person who is manipulative. But he's manipulating toward a goal that they both seem to want.
Right.
Which makes it very challenging and hard to watch and uncomfortable.
That's.
But it's nothing like an Aronofsky film.
Okay.
Yeah.
I have a threshold for depressing crap.
And one of the reasons when rewatching La La Land, I have it on like a 4K Blu-ray. Visually, it's fantastic. The sound mix doesn't get me.
That's the problem that I have with it. The actual sound mix of the music doesn't make me like, this is awesome.
When I saw that in the theater on New Year's after I'd had dinner and a couple of drinks and was getting ready to come over to your house for a party, it was a transcendent experience.
I felt
it was
the same
a very
way
good
I saw
experience.
It. Yeah.
So I hope they get the sound mix right for First Man because I want to feel like Dolby Atmos. You had Ryan Gosling in Blade Runner. Blade Runner was like, in 2049, audibly a transcendent experience. Yeah.
I've seen multiple times just to experience different audio.
So the one thing that made me really excited about that trailer was that it looked like the descent when they were looking for landing sites and they had to find the right spot and they had a split second left before they had to abort or die on the moon.
Right.
That trailer, like that scene's there.
Dude, you don't have to add any drama to the first moon landing at all.
No.
No.
The whole thing's terrifying So I'm very excited.
I am excited too. I also, I said this a couple weeks ago, but Roman Mars has been my safe space lately. Mm-hmm. And last week he did 99% Invisible, did a program on the Emeco Navy chair. And I went on to Craigslist.
What?
And I bought one. 77 unique steps to make one of the most durable chairs ever designed. It weighs almost nothing.
It says Emeco right in the back.
It says Emeco. Yeah. It's got the distinctive three welds at the top of the uprights.
It's funny because like I never realized that was a ubiquitous design that you don't think of it as being a designed object.
And they actually have they have a special type of trademark on this design. And the part of 99% Invisible's coverage is about how much they work to legally defend that trademark on this chair.
Excellent.
Very interesting.
So it's a lot like we haven't covered the chairs in the cave, but every single chair around this table has a history. We've got a Tom Sachs NASA chair. We've got the bus chair from the Speed Mythbusters episode. The fiberglass.
Really? That's what that one is?
Yeah.
I had no idea.
Yeah. The fiberglass chair you're sitting in was designed by Noel for the Seattle Space Needle. It's a chair my wife introduced me to and that we've always loved. And we found two of them on eBay. First Dibs a few years back.
It's my favorite.
I'm going to stop you right there because we're saving the rest of that for a video.
The history of the chairs in the cave. There's a lot of stories in these.
Yeah.
Cool.
Exciting.
I guess that's as good a place as any to wrap it up.
Movie-wise, things are heating up. Incredibles 2 comes out this weekend.
Atmos tickets for Saturday afternoon.
Cannot wait.
I'm very excited. I am debating
the
usually.
Score, Michael Giacchino's score. Yep. I actually got to hear a little bit of it when Michael came to town, and it sounds
reviews
amazing.
Have been fantastic. I know
John Landis, by the way, says that the Incredibles score is the best James Bond score ever.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No doubt.
Easily. Yeah.
Like the theme when Elastigirl is riding the monorail. It's so good. Into the hidden evil base.
I cannot wait. I've seen a tiny bit of footage of the opening sequence, and it's like it's going to be worth the wait.
So my daughter is very excited about this. She has been pretending she's a Violet for the last several weeks, And last night she told us that she and her best friend are making The Incredibles 3. So sorry, Brad Bird. And also Norm has to be syndrome.
Yeah, I got a voicemail from your daughter.
Did you really?
For your 4-year-old daughter saying, five-year-old, that I got to be syndrome.
Norm is syndrome. She likes the bad guys. She thinks it's very...
That's the villain.
Look, Norm, her favorite characters are Joker from Lego Batman. Mm. Like, we have some problems we got to work through. She loves the Stormtroopers.
We're in the great pantheon.
Look, evil genius. At least she's still a genius.
Right, evil genius is still gets into a good school. Oh.
And then
Ted Cruz as a
as a Zodiac. Wait, what?
I know. Also, Ocean's 8 is in theaters.
I want to go see that.
Ocean's 8.
Yeah.
Also, I listen to a lot of the Crooked Media podcast. Pod Save America, Love It or Leave It, Pod Save the World. This week or last week on Crooked Conversations, they interviewed Lawrence Tribe, who was Obama's law professor. Also, I mean, Lawrence Tribe is insane. Like, he taught Obama, he taught two Supreme Court justices and Ted Cruz. They all worked for him at some point. Like, this guy is, and listening to him discuss why, even if you are vehemently against Trump, why impeachment is not something you should hope for. He makes a very cogent case about the cost of failure of initiating such a procedure.
Yeah. Well, there's a reason the framers set it up as the last resort, right?
But it's also delightful to hear such an incredibly intelligent mind. Mm. His analysis of each thing he talks about within the Crooked Conversations is just riveting. But those are the podcasts I've been listening to.
Okay, very good.
A little bit of politics, a little bit of design.
You know, going back to Incredibles, because I don't want to start a whole different tangent. So I'm going to end here.
Yeah.
You have a child, Will, so I know you have to watch it with your kid. I don't have a child yet, so I have the option of going at night or like a matinee. Typically, I would do a matinee because cheaper, fewer crowds. But this is a kids' movie. It's summer. Kids, do you want to be in a room with 200 children watching this?
200.
I'm going to tell you a secret. If you pay the extra $5 for Dolby Atmos at the Metreon, there will be very few children there, and the seats are reserved.
Right. And I know that's an option.
But do you want the kids?
Right.
No.
Which experience do you want? Okay. So you as a...
I see a lot of kids' movies. You do not want the kids. The kids go to the screen. Go to a screen that'll have...
terrible audience members.
A few kids.
They're so selfish.
Maybe for the second.
It's all about
Look,
this time, clothe me.
In 2 years, when you're like, I got to get out of the house and my wife needs a break. Let's go see Open Season 3 and you want to gouge your eyes out? And
then do that.
Then go see the kids showing. But for this one, enjoy the time you have.
Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory.
Oh, the Johnny Depp one?
No.
Oh,
I've never seen that one. The original one.
The Johnny Depp one isn't as bad as everybody once says it is, but those Alice in Wonderland movies are atrocious.
Are they?
$1 billion.
Any of them. I love, what's her name? The actress.
Mia.
The girl who plays Alice.
She's good. She was on In Treatment. She's phenomenal on In Treatment. Huh. She's one of the patients. Terrific actress.
So.
Oh, she's also in Crimson Peak.
The performances are really good. The problem is that it's just not. Like, why it's unnecessary and late Tim Burton
the
is not
thing
great.
That doesn't excite me, but I find it entertaining that Johnny Depp has killed Tim Burton's wife in so many different movies.
Oh, so over and over again. Well, ex-wife now, I think, right?
Ex-wife.
Yeah. So, I mean, maybe. Hmm? Okay. Well, we'll see you at the Incredibles this weekend.
We went on a roller coaster there from really sad and dark to laughing, and that feels a little strange, but that's also kind of the reality.
It's kind of how life works, right?
Yeah.
We got some good stuff on the site. Now I'm here. I can talk about the stuff. The last episode of our miniseries with Zoe Bell just went up today. So you haven't had a chance
to
watch that.
She's still drifting out in the desert, right?
Watch that.
And the supercut of the extended cut of me shooting the dinosaurs with the 1,000-shot Nerf gun.
That video really blew up.
The night after that video went out, I was streaming on Twitch, as I often do, and so many people came into chat and were like, hey, was that you and the dinosaurs? And I was like, no, it was Norman Gunther. Clearly Norman Gunther.
Norm and Teague.
Oh, and Teague.
Yeah, Teague, one of the assistants from the shop up there. YouTube can write us that check for $1,000 now.
Ooh.
Nice. We will take that.
Yes.
Yes.
That's
what
it.
What else is anything else on the site?
And we'll also tease, back in April, Adam did an incognito walk with one of our friends, friend of the site, Broken Nerd, Daryl Maloney.
Broken Nerd, Daryl Maloney is so amazing.
And the thing that, if you watch that incognito walk, Adam pointed out that Daryl spent a week here in the cave working, building those costumes with Adam. And we
documented
we documented that entire process. And we're just about to wrap up our edit of that. It's going to be another mini-series like the Zoe Bell project we did.
Cool.
So that's going to roll out in the site hopefully in a week or two, but wanted to prime you guys for that.
Fabulous.
Excellent. Well, cool. Thanks for watching, everybody, and we'll see you all next week.
Thank you, guys.
Bye. One more thing.
What?
I want to know what everybody's favorite Parts Unknown and No Reservations episodes are.
Yeah.
Please post them in the comments, because I've been, like, I watched the Waffle House one. I went back to Myanmar, Vietnam.
Actually, I'm going to extend this one more second.
Yeah.
Because stories of going to the restaurants that you saw, we found out about Pied de Cochon, Feet of the Pig, an amazing restaurant in Montreal. The first time my wife and I went, this is now like 12 years ago, and we had deep fried foie gras balls, and the waiter sat down at our table after the entrees. He sat down at our table with a bottle of Bushmills and 3 shot glasses. And we had one of the greatest nights of our lives at that restaurant, and it's all because he covered it.
That sounds exceptional.
Like, let's hear your stories about that in the comments.
Please, yes. Favorite Bourdain stories, memories, Parts Unknowns episodes, whatever. Post them. We want to hear them.
All right.
Thanks for watching, everybody.
Bye, guys.
Bye.